Hi, this is Bob Sorrentino from Italian Roots and Genealogy, and you can find us on Facebook and YouTube. And very excited today to have a brilliant author who wrote the book Brilliant Bodies, Tim McCall. So welcome, Tim. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks.
So I think the most obvious question is, what is or who are Brilliant Bodies?
All right. Well, so my book is about 15th century Italian princes for the most part. And it's a study of their fashion and adornment and their bodies. You know, I think today, certainly in the 21st century, although this is changing, we have a sense that, you know, looking fashionable is something that powerful men avoid. In the 15th century in Italy, elsewhere, but particularly in Italy, it was important for men to show off their wealth, the powerful ones, the nobles, the lords of throughout Italy that I focus on. And one of the ways that this was constructed, one of the ways that this was done, was through shininess, through brilliance, through radiance. And I found this both in kind of like in literary in literary propaganda and literary ideologies, that these men are constantly being described as, you know, shining more than the sun, or, you know, it's also connected to beauty. And there's a real sense that there's aristocratic status connected with this very kind of shiny, radiant beauty, which I also find manifested in their clothes and in their adornment. And these men were well adorned. They were wearing pearls. They're wearing gems. A lot of times they weren't true gems, but they were glass paste. I found their clothing was just drenched in metal, whether it was brass, gold. They always said it was gold. It wasn't quite always gold. And all kind of all different forms. What we think of like gold brocade. So where it actually would be gold threads or silk threads wrapped in metal or gilded or gold metal actually woven into the textiles, or just all kinds of little bits and pieces of metal that would be sewn on everywhere. So this was the way that they showed their power. This is the way that they convinced the people that they ruled that they should be in power. It was sort of incumbent upon them to be these beautiful, but also brilliant, radiant, splendid bodies. And so many of the adjectives that were used to describe them, some in one way or another relate to light. So there was this sense, you know, and this is against the majority of the people that they ruled that would have had much more drab clothing, literally lackluster clothing, particularly clothing that was dyed also with less expensive materials. That's another part of it, that these men wore silks that shone a lot, that, you know, they had surface and light effects that most people's clothing didn't. And we sort of, the other thing is that these silks were very colorful. We take for granted that we can wear whatever clothes we want, whatever color clothes we want, for quite cheaply, because we have modern synthetic dyes that weren't available at this time. So wearing something like a shiny red was something that very few people could afford. And in fact, there were laws that allowed, in the 15th century, that allowed only certain people to wear it. So this was all about status and the importance of putting a particular aristocratic, you know, face forward, but more than just the face, literally from head to toe. And it both in terms of the textiles, but also adornment. So when I think about brilliant bodies and also skin was super important at the time too, right? This shiny. So even men used cosmetics. They used things to bleach their hair to make their hair blonde. So it was a sort of, it was their bodies in total, everything that they put forward when they were on display.
Yeah. And there were so many fascinating things in the book. I mean, you kind of mentioned the, the laws and everything like that. I was blown away by that you could go to jail or worse if you were wearing the wrong clothes or making the wrong clothes or I wasn't surprised about the jewelry that, you know, if you were creating fake, you know, things that you said were gold and stuff like that. But the fact that you could only wear certain clothes, that was pretty funny.
Yeah. So it's a thing called sumptuary laws, which have existed in throughout the globe. And there's like been a really interesting recent study by in case any of your readers or listeners are interested, by George Ariello and Ulinka Rublak about global sumptuary laws. But they were essentially Well, there are lots of debates about what they actually did and how often they were enforced. Some cities they weren't enforced, some they were. And essentially say that certain levels of people could wear certain clothing, certain textiles, certain colors, certain lengths of clothing. It was a way that, you know, the idea was the city wouldn't spend too much money, wouldn't sort of dissipate its wealth. It also like kept people in line. But of course, if you're told not to wear something, a lot of people were very resourceful, even sort of below the status line. It would find ways to wear something like that or to mimic it in certain ways. So it was something that was negotiated a lot, just I guess like all laws are negotiated. But and then absolutely too, like I found a couple examples of people who were doing the wrong thing with fake gems and fake gold and were punished for it. It was never the audience, fooling the audience wasn't a problem. It was fooling the buyer that would get you in trouble. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you could make false gems and set them in false gold all you wanted, as long as the buyer knew what they were getting, that was fine. The buyer could fool, you know, the prince could fool all of the people about the authenticity of their materials, but you couldn't misrepresent something and sell something, because that looked bad on the whole guild, the whole system of glassmakers or goldsmiths or whoever it was. So that's why you would be punished for misrepresenting your wares to the buyer.
Yeah, and what also was something that I didn't realize, that they would go out of, I mean, they would dress their courtiers like, you know, 10, 20 or more.
Yes.
Outfit them for these, you know, parades or festivals and things like that. I didn't realize the amount of money was actually being spent on clothes and jewels.
Absolutely. In a certain way, you know, there were Galeazzo Maria Sforza, the Duke of Milan, who was assassinated. There's probably a good number of reasons he was assassinated, historians have pointed to, but one of them was essentially he bankrupted his family and the Milanese state. He put on the powerful people of Milan such problematic and onerous forced loans so that he could pay for all of his clothing that they turned against him eventually. And you're right, it's not only for his clothing, but it was important to have your entourage dressed out too. And some of the laws were actually about that. For instance, in Milan, this color called Morello, which is murrey, literally, it's kind of a purple violet color, sort of red also, was reserved only for people who had permission to wear it, particularly men's stockings, which were men at this, younger men in particular, wore relatively short clothing in this period and showed off their legs. This was a sign of sort of male beauty and masculinity more generally. So it was illegal for certain people to wear this color of stocking. And they were, you had to have a license that some of the time you had to carry around with you. So at certain moments, the prince wanted this to be checked. You know, he complained, oh, there's too many people walking around the streets wearing this color. This can't be right. Part of it was people want to show that they're connected to the prince, right? It's a political posturing. Part of it also is that there's all these stockings out there that, if you are a part of the court, you might be given, you know, a six or a dozen of them a couple times a year. So when they get old, you still want to do something with them. Clothing at this period is also sort of like cash. There are huge, much more elaborate sort of systems of pawning, right, in pawn shops at this time. And so much stuff was bought on credit, right? Obviously, they didn't have credit cards. Cash was harder to find because of, you know, there wasn't any paper cash, right? So clothing was something that was constantly traded. So probably a lot of those people were just wearing second or third hand clothing too, right? Because the market had been gutted for these stockings because they were given out so much. Having courtiers wear them in the first place was important to the Lord's power also, right? That it was important that not only he be shown to be brilliant, but his family members, which would include his children, his mistress, his wife, or I should say probably his mistresses, his wife, but also just important courtiers would wear very expensive clothing as well. And, you know, sort of surrounding him, I say brilliance is not really only an individual thing. It was a corporate thing, right? The whole court had to show this off. For instance, and this was another way that you could show your wealth, that even if the people who serve you, right, who would be wearing very expensive clothing and livery, if they could wear something that, you know, was unavailable to the majority of the citizens, whether because of price or because of the sumptuary laws. Well, that was a real display of wealth also. And that was a real display of status too, right? That, look, even my lowest servant or the people who I have enslaved, right, they can dress fancier than you can. This is a real display of my power.
Yeah, and what was really interesting too was the fact that a lot of this was put on the men. You know, they were dressed. I'm sure the women dressed too. But you know, when you watch these shows about the 14th, 15th, 16th century, you always see the women in these fancy gowns and the jewels and everything, and the men not so much. But it was almost the opposite. With a lot of emphasis, and I guess because they were the lord, was put on the man.
Right. And so all the things I'm describing apply to women too, aristocratic women in early Renaissance Italy, that it was important that they be described as blonde and beautiful and with shining faces. And they wore, you know, colorful silks, and they wore jewels as well. They probably did wear more jewels than men, but men wore quite a bit also. The main difference is, though, that women, because of understandings of like public and private and understandings of gender and power, were on display a lot less, right? If a woman was constantly walking through the streets, as some of these princes were, that would be sort of too available. She was on display during important feast days, during New Year's Eve, certainly at weddings in the family. And at her wedding, she was dressed in, you know, sort of insanely beautiful. But she was sort of like momentarily key to power in terms of its display. And that's what I'm talking about. A lot of like this book is more about sort of representation more than reality, or how those intersect, right? Men, it was more incumbent on men to be on display quite a bit more. So that's one of the reasons why there's an emphasis on men. The other reason is sort of to address sort of the, you know, our assumptions, right? Which is that men aren't fashionable and men wouldn't be wearing shiny things. But this is a moment when they were, and they did, and doing so, wearing these shiny things is absolutely necessary for them to control power. Things change in the next century. And men's in the 16th century, in the 1500s, men's clothing becomes a lot darker. And there's a real fashion for black. And there is at certain moments in the 15th century as well. And as you know, the end of my book, the epilogue talks about this, the kind of like fade to black, or I think I call it black is the new gold, yeah. Right? Kind of playing on everything in fashion being the new black. But at that moment too, I should say, black clothing was also at this time very expensively dyed, very lustrous, and it showed off pearls and gems. So most princes wearing black also showed off some, they weren't sort of like drenched in gems and drenched in pearls, but they wore some of them. And this black was very, very lustrous. So there even remained this emphasis on shininess, just in a different way, when there was this very important kind of change from what I describe in the 15th century.
Yeah. And, you know, we always associate, at least I did growing up, you know, the Silk Road, and we always associated with all the silk coming from China. At least I did. That's what I was taught in grammar school and high school. And I didn't know until I went to Italy last year to visit one of my ancestors' homes that they had silkworms and a silk industry at the bottom of their palazzo. And so a lot of silk was being made in Italy. Yeah.
Absolutely. And it did come from China and through, you know, sort of the Near East, and some of the earliest Italian, what's now Italian silk industry was in Sicily. But by the 1300s, it had sort of spread enough into southern Italy. There was production in Spain also, but the first real Italian center for silk production was Lucca. And by the 14th century, Lucca, and they were also copying a lot of different weaves and patterns, so that what they were producing looked like it could have come from what's now Iran, from the Near East. And then it spread from there. Venice and Florence had very important silk industries, right? Venice obviously had trading connections with the Silk Road, essentially. So they could get a lot of different materials from that way. And it wasn't until the 15th century that Milan, which is a city whose silk industry I look at quite a bit, really blew up. And it didn't really start till the 1440s. But then by the end of the century, within three or four decades, they were planting mulberry trees, which white mulberry is what this type of silkworm fed on in Renaissance Europe, were being planted everywhere, just groves and groves of them. And for the next couple of centuries, this was one of Milan's most important industries. So there was a lot of money in it, obviously. And then it certainly spread all over Italy. And there were a good, dozen cities that had legitimate silk industries. And then a lot of other cities that had much smaller ones, right? To the extent, as you're describing, that there was quite a bit of production on lower levels as well too, but very important production.
Yeah, because this is on a mountaintop in Calabria where they have silkworms. So,
and right now I'm having a mind blank on the name. I think it's called Nido di Seta or silk nest. But I could, in the last decade or so in Calabria, there's a sort of cooperative run by artisans and scholars that are actually trying to remake silk through the early, with only early modern technologies and materials. I mean, it's a place that I know some scholars have gone to kind of learn the process, which is, super interesting, doing this kind of reconstructive history to try to figure out what we might have missed by thinking about the ways that things were made, clothing, but other things were made in earlier centuries.
Well, yeah, and there's a lot of that going around in Italy too. Not, in agriculture, especially when we in Capocotta, they had a couple of very young guys who started doing farming lentils and olive oil. Now there's a lot of olive oil production going organic. So it's kind of like a whole new thing in Italy to go back to the old ways, and with very young people, which is refreshing. So you mentioned a lot of people in the book that I actually descend from. But my favorite I never had heard of her until I was doing my research was Isabella d'Este. In my book, I mentioned her as I see her as the Jackie Kennedy of the Renaissance, a brilliant woman, very fashionable. And she was married to somebody who he liked to fight, but not do too much else.
And he never had enough money for Isabella's desires to all the art that she wanted to collect. She was extremely knowledgeable in terms of fashion. She's constantly writing letters showing that she wants to buy things and also that she only wants the best things, right? There's one letter where she says, I want the best black silk you can find in Venice. And if it's not good, then don't even waste your time on it. She also traded, learned about fashion through trading little dress dolls. This was something that not she, right, but others did as, I mean, not only she, but others did as well. Some were even sent up to France. What is the fashion in France? Because her son was a hostage a few times of Pope Julius II, and then also of Francois, the King of France. So she was extremely interested in what everyone else was wearing. This was part of her diplomacy as well. I think a few scholars have shown. Yeah, she's amazing. And the one thing I got very excited about and it's in the book somewhere, is that I found this reference to when her uncle Borso died without any heirs, a bunch of his clothes were cut up and resewn for her when she was 1.5 or 2 years old and her sister, right? So these are very expensive velvets that it's such a powerful, it's such important material that you don't want to waste it. So even as a little girl, she was wearing, princely, and of course she was, but to see this connection from her uncle, literally his clothing being retailored for a toddler was kind of exciting.
Yeah. And Francesco, he disappeared a lot. I mean, he's always out on some kind of, military journey or something like that, or messing around with Lucrezia Borgia.
And part of the time their son was always held hostage in lieu of him. Right?
Oh, really?
That is certainly the case for the Pope. It was, so they sent the 10-year-old down to Rome rather than have his father And that's an amazing story too, because when he was 10 years old down there, he saw Raphael painting the Stanze, the School of Athens, for instance, and he wrote back to mom saying, you know, you got to know about this new painter. His name's Raphael. He also went up on the scaffolding halfway through the Sistine Chapel being painted. There was a moment where they stopped, and I don't know if you look closely.
Yes, I remember. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the figures get much larger because Michelangelo kind of saw it from below and said, okay, we need to change this a little bit. He was there then. And the Lacoan, one of the most important statues from antiquity, which was found, I can't remember, 1506 or 1509. He tried to buy for his mom. He was like, you'd really, really like this. He was down there between 10 and 12 years old. It's still in the Vatican. It's in the Belvedere courtyard. So he was unsuccessful. He didn't get it to send home to mom in Mantua.
We'll be right back.
Italian Roots and Genealogy is proudly sponsored by Your Dolce Vita and Dawn Matera, connecting people to their purpose in life and continuing their legacy. For more information, contact Dawn at www.yourdolcevita.com. I didn't realize that all these letters existed. Where can I find them? Are they online someplace?
A lot of them are, actually. There's Mantua is one of the best archives, best in terms of surviving materials. Also because a lot of times they made copy letter books where every letter that was going out or being received, a scribe would copy. So a lot of times we do have the letters, but sometimes we have a copy of the letter. And a lot of the letters of Isabella d'Este have been published. There's a book in English that came out maybe 3 or 4 years ago it's like this thick. It's got to be over 1,000 of her letters translated by Deanna Shemek.
Wow.
And I have it right here somewhere, but it's Deanna Shemek, who's a professor at Cal Irvine. She's also done this webpage called IDEA. I think it's, I can't remember exactly what it stands for, IDEA, Isabella d'Este, correspondence, essentially. I think you have to register for it. But on there, and I think most of the letters are transcribed, but still in Italian, there's a huge array of things that you can find. And that, if you want to read some of her letters. The recent book on Isabella d'Este's letters by Deanna Shemek would be a great place to start.
Yeah, I have to look into that because I just found it to be, you know, so fascinating. And what really bummed me out when they made the series, The Borgias, they made her out to be like a crazy person.
I haven't seen that. I know I should have.
It's really, well, we were sitting there watching it and I'm saying that's to my wife. That's my grandfather. That's my grandmother. That's my grandfather. Because I also come from Paul III.
Okay. Farnese,
yeah.
Isabella had, I think, in the 19th century, she was held up as this great patron, you know, the patron of arts. But some people said she was, you know, then there was this idea, I think, for a couple of decades in scholarship, that she was too pedantic, because there's this famous letter to Perugino, the artist, about a painting that exists in the Louvre, the Battle the Battle Between Love and Chastity, where she gives really exacting instructions. And because of these instructions, it's actually not a great painting. The figures are sort of too small. And so I think because of that letter, people for a couple of centuries thought she was sort of overbearing. But in the last couple of decades, there's been a lot of research on Isabella. And I think we've seen her as a much more interesting and just really kind of superbly smart and operating person. So I wouldn't be surprised if sort of like the Borgia scholarship was a couple decades behind and was sort of based on this earlier idea of Isabella is, yeah, a little nuts and overbearing and a pain to deal with.
Yeah, well,
which I think is not true in a lot of ways.
The bits that I read, I didn't think so. So another person that you talk a lot about, or family, but specifically is Federico Montefeltro.
Yes,
and apparently he really liked to dress up. And you mentioned that these garments that they wore were very, very heavy, and there were layers of undergarments and things like that.
Absolutely. And it wrecked bodies over time too. So there's this great, it's a father and son forensic pathologists from University of Pisa who have studied a lot of these, a lot of the bodies of these princes, particularly Naples and Florence, but Federico de Montefeltro also. They were sort of embalmed a little bit, so they've kept relatively well. And he's found, Fornaciari has found sort of like deformations to some of the bones from wearing heavy armor, from riding on horseback, particularly to the lower back problems there. He has some sense of their diet too, but a lot of times they would have been dressed in, you know, many layers with weapons, with bits and pieces of armor. These princes didn't go around ever wearing what we would call like a suit of armor, which is a little bit anachronistic, but they would very often wear layers, and, you know, in a part of armor. They wore protective clothing, often with mail or with leather, sometimes underneath, because they were, you know, there was all kinds of assassination attempts on them, sometimes underneath their clothes. So it wouldn't be surprising for a prince, when he was on display, when he was seen by people, to be wearing very, very heavy velvets, drenched in metal, with, you know, plate metal armor on bits and pieces of them. It certainly changed the way that these men walked. They had to carry themselves a particular way, and it probably did weigh very heavily on the body. He was extremely interested in putting a good foot forward. The one moment I talk about, I mean, he's famous for having a disfigured face. We always see him from one side, and he lost an eye, right? But he still, I mean, it tells us how powerful Renaissance art is, that we, even though he's disfigured on one face, we never see it, even though we kind of know it's there, but he has a very memorable profile, right? If you've been to the Uffizi, or you've traveled in Italy, you can recognize him immediately, right? And that's because of what art produces. And I think that's an interesting point. And the other one that I talk about is he really damaged his legs, his foot and his lower leg, when his doctors didn't think he was going to survive, where he fell down rotted stairs in one of his castles about a floor down, and he had a compound fracture, right? So the bone was sticking out. And he was seriously, for a couple of months, he was totally laid up. But eventually, when he healed enough that he could move around, he still, his city, Urbino, he still wanted to be seen every day. So he had this contraption created on his horse, where he had a leg sort of like, he couldn't bend his leg, and he couldn't sit normally on a horse. So he had that one leg sort of up, angled diagonally up, sort of up the horse's head. So he sat, I mean, funny, but it was a way that he could actually sit and be comfortable. And at one point when he was being taken off the horse, a Florentine ambassador saw him like grimacing and moaning in pain. And he got very, very upset about that, because he didn't want word to go back to any allies that he wasn't as strong as he was, even though everyone knew about this like horrific injury he had. So he, you know, he got quite upset at the people who allowed the ambassador to be there at that moment. Tells you again how concerned these men are about their appearances and how people see them.
Well, yeah, and I especially like the part where if they were getting a little too portly, that wasn't very good either.
Absolutely. They were very concerned about that. They're mean, and their sisters are, and mothers, yes, are mean, and fathers are mean. They make fun of them. They tell them to stop eating. There's definitely body shaming going on amongst the aristocracy of 15th century Italy.
And it's hard to imagine an Italian mother telling the son not to eat, because we grew up just the opposite. Mangia.
Right. Well, the example is essentially, and it's another Gonzaga, Ludovico Gonzaga, who he's talking about this much later in his life, but he's thinking back to his dad, who was saying that he was so overweight as a child that he was going to make his younger brother prince.
Yes, that was so mean. Better.
And you know, the worst thing. So he says he starts dieting and he only drinks water, and he eventually did become prince, but you know, it's kind of brutal.
And you know, you mentioned a little earlier about cosmetics and stuff. I had no idea that the blonde hair was such a big deal And, you know, you mentioned that they had teeth whiteners and skin whiteners and things like that. I had no idea any of that stuff existed. That was really eye-opening.
Yeah, it's amazing. In fact, there's a brand new book that just came out, I think this week, by Jill Burke, who's a professor at University of Edinburgh, on, I think it's, I can't remember the title off the top of my head, but it's something like how to be a beautiful woman in Renaissance Italy. Or it might just be how to be a woman in Renaissance Italy. And it's mainly about obviously women from the title, but it's all about all these cosmetic recipes, some of which she and a couple of other scholars have been recreating and trying to figure out, because a lot of them were totally toxic and we couldn't use them, or we shouldn't use them today. You know, they cause as many issues to the skin over time as much as they helped. But that, yeah, that's another thing that, like, my book was helped by the fact that there are all these great people working on it, at, you know, in the last couple of years on these cosmetics.
Yeah, well, I have to try and contact her. I'd love to have a conversation with her. That's absolutely fascinating. Like I said, the one that really got me was teeth whiteners.
Yes.
No idea. And some people were actually destroying their teeth to try to keep them
right.
White.
Yes. And I mean, that's something I always say that to a lot of us that have, you know, that have enjoyed modern dentistry, that if we were taken in a time machine back to the 15th century, that'd be the first giveaway, right? Once we opened our mouth and smiled, they'd say, you know, where do you come from? Look at Renaissance paintings. See how often you see someone showing their teeth. It's very rarely. And it's usually people of sort of the lower class. People smile, but not that much. And it's not a mouth opening smile. And I think there are different reasons that relate to decorum, but I think one of them absolutely is that. And so, you know, and so some of these princes could afford to try, you know, weird remedies and potions, and did try to whiten their teeth and sometimes scraped away at them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. I don't like dentists, so I'm not scraping anything. I'm not a big fan of dentists, that's for sure. And so, you know, why did you pick this topic? I mean, I you know, I know you've done a lot of writing and everything, but, you know, what drove you to come up with this?
Right. Well, so, I mean, it was something that I was sort of working on for many, many years. That it took a while for me to get to this point. My dissertation was on this prince of who ruled Parma in the 15th century, when art in Parma is very well studied in the later Renaissance and in the 16th century with artists like Correggio and Parmigianino, but not in the 1400s, not in the 15th century. And I looked at these fresco cycles that relate in different ways to the prince sort of being shown as a knight, and then with representations of his mistress. This is from a castle called Torre Chiara, which is just a little bit south of Parma. And then this prince also commissioned a fresco cycle in another one of his castles that shows the Griselda tale, which is the hundredth of the Decameron's tales. It's also the story that Chaucer tells in Canterbury Tales, is the Clark's tale. It's a different version. Anyway, there's just really interesting ideas about gender and power in both of these stories. And as I was sort of beginning to publish this, I realized people didn't really understand that it was really about masculinity, that even though women were in a certain way kind of like what people had talked about, everything that these women in these frescoes were doing were all about making the prince look like a better prince. It was less about them and it was more about him. So I started thinking more kind of critically about that, I think, and more intentionally about that. And then I realized that just no one had talked about the clothing that these men are wearing, and that this was just as important part of their sort of their, what we call their self-fashioning, of the way that they presented themselves, right? Not necessarily how they looked, but how they wanted people to think they looked, right? And where did representation and fantasy and reality, how did all these levels sort of align? So it took, you know, I started really working on this book when I was on a sabbatical in Florence in like 2010, 2011. So it took over a decade for me to sort of assemble all the material. And I think, you know, since you've read the book, you get a sense that it's really anecdotal. You know, there's a lot of like, I have a point and then I sort of back it up with a bunch of different stories, most of which I get from correspondence. So I had this idea, but it was always kind of shifting the more and more as I read. And yeah, it was a study that I'm glad I had like well over a decade to write, because that made it all the more rich. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, I could, you know, reading through it, I could, it's quite evident how much work went into it. I mean, I know when I was doing mine, it was so hard, you know, trying to document the things and find out about some of these families. And, you know, and you mentioned, and I have a lot of it in my family. There was always somebody trying to poison, stab.
Yes.
Ransom. People don't realize how much of this was going on, you know.
Yeah, could be an outsider, could be someone in your family too.
Yeah, brothers, uncles, yeah. Cousins. I mean, it was,
absolutely.
And they'd be on one side one day, and the next day they were on the other side. And you know, that's kind of why I did it too, is because, you know, we hear so much, we know so much about, you know, Spanish royal and nobles, and the English especially, and the French. Very little is written about the Italians, that, you know, for just, you know, regular people like myself, or very few, you know, documentaries or movies highlighting this kind of stuff, like the Borgias we mentioned is one of them. And I'm so thrilled to see that they're actually doing a series in Italy now. Netflix is doing it on the Leopard. Somebody posted it off, some of my friends posted it on Facebook, and I was like, oh wow, this is going to be fabulous, because you know, the movie is it's a little outdated now,
right?
It was 50 years ago, 60 years ago, whatever it was. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to
Sicily
that.
Needs more attention too. The Sicilian nobility needs more attention, so that'll be
yes,
good.
Yes. And I interviewed maybe about a month ago, Carlo Treviso, who wrote about the 12, I guess it was around 1237 or something like that, the Sicilian revolt, against the French. And it's a historical novel, but it's riveting, really, really, really good book.
Interesting.
And it tells the story over, I guess, maybe 2 weeks or something like that. And it's Siciliana. That's the main character. That's, you know, she uses that name. So so now, before we go, I know you're in the process. I think it's coming out in November. You have a new book coming out, correct?
Yes. And it's a lot of the same characters, but it's not about clothing and fashion. It's called Making the Renaissance Man, and it's coming out with Reaction Books in the UK, I think in like 2 weeks, but it'll take a month or two for it to get to the US. And it's on essentially, you know, all the things that these men had to do other than wear shiny things to become men. So it's a little bit of history of sex and sexuality. Mistresses, for instance, are an important part of it. I have a lot of new information on Leonardo da Vinci's girl with an ermine, right? Lady with an ermine, which was the mistress of one of the Milanese dukes, Ludovico Sforza. It's a lot about jousts, hunting. There's a chapter on animals, from falcons to dogs to horses to cheetahs. I have a section on cheetah hunting, which was wow, super fashionable in the late 1400s. Jousts, all the kind of like, you know, chivalric spectacle that you associate with it. So I think that book's going to be like $35 or something, which I'm very excited about, coming out in a couple of months, a month or two.
Well, I'm going to read it, and then we're going to do another one of these, because that's absolutely fascinating to me. Because there's just not enough about it. People don't understand enough about the Italian history. You know, we know about Rome, and, you know, we know about the unification in the 1860s. And in between, we don't know anything, you know. Right. So for anybody listening who really wants to understand at least Italian fashion for now, and then later on, we'll get into how to be a manly man.
Yes.
Stay tuned.
Which is not necessarily our, you know, and this part of the title is, it's not really our expectations of what it means to be a man, right?
Yes.
But so it's good to denaturalize things through history, right? The way that we have it hasn't always been the ways that things are, the way things have to be. So it's, again, very much like a deep dive into a moment to learn about them, but maybe also to think about what we take for granted also.
Yeah, no, I can't wait. I can't wait. And, you know, my wife and I always say, wouldn't it be nice to be able to, you know, drop in on history, you know, and view it from above and
Cover
see
your
what
mouth.
really went on, you
That's my advice.
Good. So last question, where could people find you? Where can people find the book?
So, I mean, it's on, you can order The Brilliant Bodies is through Penn State University Press. You can order it online from them. It's also on Amazon. And then the book that's coming out, Making the Renaissance Man, I think is also order, you can pre-order it on Amazon. And it'll be, it's in the UK, it's with Reaction, which is a great press that does a lot of art history. And I think it's University of Chicago Press that distributes them in the US. But you know, it's better to buy from the presses, but it's easier to buy from Amazon.
Right.
And they're both
Yeah. No,
available.
I find the same thing. Well, thanks very much, Tim. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob. This was fun. It's good to meet you and good to talk about this.
Yeah. Same here.